up on the webpage. You can take a look at it. And if you squint your eyes, some of the shadows look like it's almost a Valentine's heart. So it's very appropriate season. Let me drop. Now, we've discussed the first things eaten on the moon. Buzz Aldrin, one of his church's elders, snuck a communion wafer and a consecrated wine at his first bit of sustenance on the moon. We also discussed what might have been the first word said on the moon by Apollo 11 astronauts, which I think is okay, the word okay. Tonight, I ask about another first. Now, not counting technical documents, what was the first published book taken to the moon? Anyone want to guess?
RIW has a guess.
Okay, Dick?
Is there anyone else who wants to make a guess? Give us the call letters.
WB2GXM. Rich?
Yes, Rich.
Our adventure today Genesis. Is the Bible. WB2GXM.
We have one vote for the Bible, and someone doubled with you, but I was able to recognize that they said Genesis, which I guess counts as the Bible as well. I'm assuming you don't mean the portion of the book. You meant the book. But, okay, so we have one vote for the Bible, one vote sort of for the Bible. Anyone else with any other guesses?
On Apollo 8, for the first time they looped around the moon without landing, on Christmas Eve they read chapter 1, verse 1 through, I don't know which verse number, of Genesis. Because of the weight of a Bible, they did not bring a complete Bible with them. They brought with them a section of the Bible called Genesis that they read. That's what I think took place. Correct me on that one, Roy. K2RIW.
No, Dick, you are completely
correct. NQHVR, it had to be fireproof.
They decided to recite the beginning of Genesis. It upset Madeline Murray O'Hare, if anyone remembers their atheist history. She was a spokeswoman for the atheist movement at the time, and most likely the noise that she provoked was one of the main reasons why when Buzz Aldrin brought his communion wafers on board, they kind of soft-pedaled it and didn't really mention it to anyone. But that doesn't qualify as the first book. That's the first, I don't know, a bunch of pages maybe? But it's not actually a book. The question is, what is the first full, complete, published book brought to the moon? More guesses. This, I'll give you this one's a difficult one if you don't know your history. It's not as obvious as I think.
You're rejecting technical manuals. You've now decided it is not a complete Bible. And there was another book brought to the moon. We're going to be asking which Apollo mission did it and what book, if it's not a technical manual or a section of the Bible. Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
And I will supply all answers when required. I just wanted to get a feeling for whether anyone could sort of guess what it might be. If I was asked the question, I would have guessed the Bible as well. It seems to me the appropriate and the very first thing. But I was just wondering if anyone had any other thoughts and ideas, what other kind of book might have been brought to the moon first.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I pretty much gave up on the chat room, so I can't possibly guess, but nowadays on the space station, you know, it's all on laptops, you know, the tablets, they're reading it that way. But the moon, they didn't have that stuff, so it must have been a real book.
Well, I'll be cagey and say yes, but not really. It was a book. Would you call it a book? Would it look like a book to you if you saw it? Chances are you wouldn't, but if by the stretch of our imaginations, it's considered a book. Other guesses? Anyone want to volunteer any great tome of literature? Okay, very well. The answer to the first published book, Carried to the Moon, it was a miniaturized copy of Robert Goddard's published biography, and it was carried by that crazy guy, Buzz Aldrin, on Apollo 11, July 20th, 1969. So that's the first published book, Carried to the Moon, Robert Goddard's biography. Now let me ask you another slight question, different question. What was the second book, Brought to the Moon? And in addition, how many books approximately do you think were either brought directly to the moon or very close to the moon? So I'm looking for another book title, and I'm looking for a number of how many books were actually shipped over near the moon or on the moon.
One of the first questions we're going to ask each other is, what's the motivation for this? In the case of, why can't I think of his name right now, one of the very early Mercury astronauts, he brought a whole lot of dimes with him, stuffed into his spacesuit. And because he had to bail out and that extra weight almost drowned him, but he was, the dimes that were brought to the moon and brought back down became very valuable. So were these books being brought to the moon so that when you bring them back down, they are valuable objects? Was that some of the motivation, Roy, KQLIW?
Yes, Dick. Part of it was to supply, important people with souvenirs, and they presented it to the Smithsonian and such. So, yeah, it was for souvenirs purposes. But there were other reasons that will come clear when I tell the story. Yes, Wesley.
And Goddard, by the way, is the guy who supposedly invented a liquid-fueled rocket. Go ahead, Wes.
There was a book not brought to the moon, but go to the moon by... And there was a second book by Ira Freeman, and that was in 1959, 10 years before the first book of his attraction.
And WS to Wes.
Yes, Paul.
I seem to remember the Jules Verne first men to the moon. I think they actually was the first men in the moon. It's the first book that wrote that was in. It had to be that one, the Jules Verne book, because it would coincide with the launch from Florida. His book actually said that. Going to go from Florida. There were going to be three people on board, and I think that was the book. I think they took that because of that reason. Back to you.
Okay, so Jules Verne. Not a bad suggestion. Very kind of appropriate for the situation. One gentleman. Bill K7WJN on Echolink is offering his opinions. One was Chariot of the Gods, which I guess is a joke, because I think Chariot of the Gods came about 10 years later, and the other is a Book of Matches, which probably is completely against NASA laws. So, anyone else with any good ideas of what might have been the second book brought to the moon? No one? Okay, I'll tell you what the book was, actually. It's the first one that you mentioned. It was the Bible. So, although I would have placed the first book as the Bible historically, for some odd reason, it took a little bit longer than Apollo 11 to get that done. So, the second book was the Bible. But let me ask you the third part of this question, which hopefully someone will try and answer. Approximately, give or take, how many books do you think were brought to the moon or near the moon?
Probably BTGX.
Yes, Rich.
My guess will be five.
Okay, that's a good number. Does anyone else want to guess any other numbers? Large, small, in between, anything.
KD2NBB.
Bob.
Yes, Roy, I'll just guess 100 for no particular reason, except maybe a lot of people wanted to do the aforementioned reason by yourself about having souvenirs handy. Back to you.
Bob, that's a good one. So we have 5, we have 100. Anyone want to guess a bigger number, say? Anyone want to guess a smaller number? Okay, doke. No one wants to play this particular game, so I will tell you my little story. One of Apollo 1's ill-fated astronauts was a guy named Edward White II. And he was quoted apparently posthumously as having wanted to bring the first Bible to the moon. Now, there was this guy, Reverend John Stout, who worked at the Manned Spacecraft Center at Houston. He worked as a chaplain to the astronauts, apparently. He decided to fulfill Edward White's wish and launched something called the Apollo Prayer League. And many astronauts seemed to be religious, and there was evidence when the crew of Apollo 8 mission, or both Bill Anders, Jim Lovell, and Frank Borman all recited from the book of Genesis, as we mentioned earlier. The problem with the Bible was NASA had a strict weight requirement, so this would apply to any books planned for any mission. Now, fortunately, the National Cash Register Company, NCR, which is still around today, had developed a method to reduce books to slivers of microfilm, and the first book that they selected to demonstrate this technology was the King James Version of the Bible by a World Publishing Company. All 1,245 pages containing 773,746 words were reduced to a transparency the size of a postage stamp at less than 2 inches square and only a fraction of a gram in weight. Let me drop for a second. Now, some of you might or might not remember Edmund Scientific, which is still around today. I bought a lot of science toys when I was a young kid. Sold copies of these microfilm Bibles at the 1964 New York World's Fair. So you could have picked one up for a couple of bucks back then. Anyway, NASA couldn't arrange any microfilm Bibles for the Apollo 11 mission, and neither for the Apollo 12 mission. But they decided to send a single postage stamp size book with the Apollo 13 mission. They actually ended up sending a roll of them that amounted to 512 Bibles in miniature. But unfortunately, we all kind of know what happened to Apollo 13. They made it back, but they never actually landed with any of the microfilm Bibles. Let me drop for a sec. So we now move on to Apollo 14. Apparently, they took a roll of those copies of those microfilms, not the same one. The original from Apollo 13 were given away as souvenirs as well, but they bought yet another roll of these microfilms. 100 copies were located in the lunar module. Another 200 copies were stored just in case in the command module, and for some strange reason, another member of the Apollo Prayer League made a final checkup of both of the modules, and he decided to sneak an additional 212 copies onto the command module so that it would have a complement of the same 512 Bibles aboard. Except that reportedly there was another microfilm Bible stored away from the lunar module, which was a little bit different than the NCR version. They called it the first lunar Bible. It had a second version of the Bible. Apollo 1, Ed White, had his preferred revised standard version of the Bible, and they placed a copy of that on the back of the usual NCR's King James Version. So after they returned to Earth, the Reverend Stout reportedly placed a unique 6-digit identifier on each copy to ensure their authenticity, and they were presented as souvenirs by astronauts and not that well-known Texan congressman involved in the Apollo Prayer League, a guy by the name of George Herbert Walker Bush, a representative of Texas, which I understand had a little famous future. Anyway, Whatever happened to the first lunar Bible, you might ask? The one with the two Bibles in it? No one seems to know. It seems to have disappeared from history. So that's my story. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, no questions, no comments. So they basically, I mean, you might consider it a cheat because it's not really paper book, because NASA wouldn't allow them to carry anything as heavy as a paper book. So it was all microfilm. But think of it, they actually trudged over to the moon with over 1,000 copies of the King James Bible. That's a lot of books.
NVB.
Yes, Bob.
That's right, so, yeah, it's a lot of books, or it's a lot of copies of one book. So I guess it's a lot of books. That's how you look at it. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, if I had to guess, I would have guessed that the Bible was the first book, and I would have guessed maybe something like four or five books, maybe. I'm not quite sure what the importance of 512 is. I looked all over the place to see if there's something biblical about 512. The only thing I could fathom is it's 8 cubed, and it's more of a numerology mathematical thing than a biblical thing, but if there are any people who know a lot more about the Bible who know what 512 might be to a Bible, please feel free.
No, it's not 8 cube. 8 cube would be 3,282.8 or something like that. 512 is 2 to the 9th power. It's a binary number. 2 to the 9th power is 512, and that's probably got something to do with it.
Okay, I'm not quite sure why it has anything particularly to do with a Bible. I mean, is 9 any kind of magical thing? You know, the Bible was really into dozens and such. There's all kinds of threes and sevens and twelves, but nines I don't think would be that important in biblical stories, but I might be wrong. I don't know. Anyway, let me throw in a short little puzzler. Maybe people will find it amusing, maybe not. We'll see. What is the simplest object in the universe? By this I mean, everything is describable for the most part. You could describe a human being, you could describe a box, you could describe all kinds of things. But it's made up of data. If you were describing a human being, it would be rather complicated, no matter what Star Trek says about transport devices. You have to describe how trillions and trillions of atoms are arranged on and their energy level and such. So my question is, of all the great celestial items in the universe, which item do you think is fundamentally the most simple in terms of being able to be described by the least number of numbers?
ABGXM.
Yes, Rich.
I believe it is a photon.
Okay, but when I'm saying a celestial object, so I'm talking about moons and supernovas and quasars and things like that. Big objects in the universe, if you had to describe them down to the bottom, which one requires the least amount of blank lines to fill in?
The universe contains more hydrogen than anything else. It's the number one item on the periodic table. It's the simplest possible element. Elements, that's a thing. Let's see now. Maybe the single proton, the single electron, maybe those are elements, but a complete object, a hydrogen atom. So if you consider an atom an object, and there's more hydrogen atoms than anything else in the universe, is that close to the answer you're looking for? K2LIW?
WS2M, put me on the list.
Okay, we'll get to you, Paul, next. I want to keep it as a heavenly body object in our universe. So let's put the size limitation that it has to be bigger than the moon. And what's your comment, Paul?
I'm going to go with the black hole because you're going to go down to the singularity. And in physics, that's like the lowest possible, you know, thing that you could describe. I'm going to go with the black hole because of that.
Excellent choice. Paul, anyone else with any ideas, any guesses or knowledge on the subject? Please, feel free.
I'm going to guess that an asteroid, since it's just a rock, WB2BX, so.
Okay, I mean, that's nice, but the problem is they're somewhat complicated. They're made out of different compositions. They have almost unique geometries. I mean, if you take a look at the picture of Bennu that I have on the website, it's not a very orderly structure. It takes a lot of three-dimensional graphing to demonstrate how it relates to itself, and then you have to describe what each atom inside the asteroid is. So it's a relatively complex structure.
There's a reason why a possible answer could be a neutron star. In the case of the Earth, the strongest stuff you've got on Earth is granite, and if you piled granite as high as you can possibly pile it, you get something like 33,000 feet. Beyond 33,000 feet, the weight will crush itself. That's why Everest is not any taller than it is, 29,000 feet. Well, that phenomenon of the local weight crushing the item, in the case of a neutron star, the local gravity is so strong that the neutron star is an extremely smooth, black, smooth surface, where the highest mountain on a neutron star is something like a thousandth of an inch high. And neutron stars can come pretty small, so when it comes to the simplest one-element object, which has the smallest amount of details, it's a pure, perfect sphere that's perfectly smooth, a neutron star is a possible candidate. Over to you, Roy, K2RAW.
Okay, that's an excellent suggestion, right up there with Paul's. K7WJN offered Quark. Once again, that's a subatomic particle. If you wanted to get into things that are kind of subatomic and such, it would be problematic. There's probably more variables for a quark than there is for some astronomical objects. There's a lot of quantum numbers that define quarks. So probably quarks, although you would think they were simple, were a bit more complicated than that. Anyway, anyone with any other suggestions of any heavenly body that might be simpler than what we've been talking about?
KQNVB.
Yes, Bob.
That's why I was going to also say neutron star 6BB2H, so I'm just a second vote for neutron star.
Okay, we got two votes for neutron star, one vote for black hole. Anyone who wants to harbor a guess?
WB2GXM.
Yes, Rich.
About an ice crystal from Saturn's rings.
Well, it certainly isn't terribly big, but you have the same problems most likely, well, slightly less than the asteroid, because there probably are inclusion items inside the ice. It's probably about 99% ice, so you have to describe the 1% that isn't ice, where it is, what it's doing, and the general geometry of the ice. So it can get rather complicated as well. Not as complicated, I'll give you, as an asteroid, but probably close. Okay, I will tell you the answer. Paul was correct. The answer, as far as I understand, is a black hole. Now, let me just ask you the follow-up question about the black hole. I mentioned that it has the least number of variables. So the question I have for the audience, if you're so inclined, is what are the different values that make up the description of every single black hole in the universe? You know, is it 50 variables? Is it 3,000 variables? Is it one variable? How many variables do you think defines all black holes in our universe?
I say four variables.
Very good. Dick votes four. Anyone with any other numbers they'd like to vote?
I'll go with three, length, width, and depth, all zeros.
But then there would be no variables, right?
Well, if you have nothing, that means you have something, so that's why you have three zeros. I don't know. Back to you, Roy.
A one variable, mass. I can think of three more.
Think of three more than the four that you mentioned?
No, four total.
Okay, yeah. I will give everyone the fact that mass is a really important thing in determining a black hole. Without knowing how much mass is in the black hole, there's a whole bunch of things that leads to that you really need to know. So it's got to have at least one variable, which is mass. The big question is, does it have a total of three variables? Does it have a total of four variables? Or does anyone want to guess any other number of variables?
In order to speed this up a little bit, I'm going to name the four variables. Mass. You could say mass and diameter. Well, once you know the mass, that determines the diameter, the Schwarzschild radius, or the surface dimension. So mass is number one. Charge is number two. Temperature is number three. Rotational moment of inertia is number four. I think that's essentially all the variables it can have. ODU Roy, K2RIW.
The actual singularity has no diameter.
Some of them are rotating, so therefore it's got rotational kinetic energy.
There's one little part of that I would tend to dispute with you, and that is temperature. Because just as you mentioned, that once I define the mass of a black hole, I've defined its event horizon dimension, because they're correlated. So too is temperature. That's what the Schwarzschild, the Hawking's radiation really amounts to, is black body radiation from a black hole. So the temperature is related to mass as well.
A whole lot of individual chunks of matter had to fall into that black hole in order to assemble it all into one place and give it that mass. Some of those chunks of matter hit it directly in the center, bullseye, and some of it hit at one angle, it's off to one side. Off to one side creates rotation. So what direction it's rotating and how fast it's rotating is a definite variable. Of the material that falls into the black hole, some of it falls in locally, some of it falls in from a long distance. Material that falls in from a long distance hits at a higher velocity, creates greater kinetic energy, greater temperature. So I say that they can have a different temperature, a different charge, a different moment of inertia, and a different amount of mass. I think those are independent variables to some degree on a black hole. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, you can have that opinion. The problem is conceptualizing the concept of temperature in an environment where space-time folds in on itself. So that, unfortunately, physicists are stuck with describing it as a point, a non-dimensional point. So ultimately, according to physicists, they ascribe only three variables to a black hole. One is the mass, very important, determines a whole bunch of things. Again, it determines the Hawking's radiation. Small black holes radiate a lot of Hawking's radiation. Very large black holes radiate a very small amount. of Hawking radiation, so that supposedly relatively small black holes created during the Big Bang were so short-lived that they've all evaporated into nothingness, and all we're left is with much larger solar black holes that have been caused by suns falling into each other. So you have gravity. You also, as you mentioned, yes, you have angular momentum. The spin of a black hole determines its deformation and other characteristics. And the third, which most people don't really think of, but it actually does exist, is charge. It's possible to have a neutrally charged black hole, but it's also theoretically possible to have a positively or negatively charged black hole. So the three variables that describe all the black holes in the universe, as far as I've read, is mass, angular momentum, and charge.
Okay. The Hawking radiation is a kind of tunneling option, operation. In other words, when the black hole is small and it's slowly evaporating by...
Repeater, time out.
It's slowly evaporating by Hawking radiation. The radiation tunnels out of there. In other words, a particle inside the black hole disappears on the outside, inside, and appears on the outside. That's what tunneling is. By some magic, it gets through the surface. Okay? How fast something tunnels is a function of the diameter of the black hole, in other words, its mass, and its temperature. If hot material fell into the black hole and it's running at a higher temperature, it is my belief that the Hawking radiation, the tunneling action, will be faster. A hot black hole will evaporate faster than a cold one. I think there can be a difference in temperature. But that's an opinion. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
Yes, Dick, and you can have an opinion on this. Most of this science is very, very theoretical at this point. Hawking radiation, unfortunately, is incredibly difficult to explain to almost anyone because it requires a very, very slight trip into something called quantum gravity, which almost no one knows much about. And this would be a very, very small special case of quantum gravity that Hawking thought that he could convince people of. But even in his popular book, he kind of completely glossed over it and talked about antimatter falling in black holes and removing mass in a black hole, which doesn't happen because antimatter has mass. It doesn't have negative mass. I don't know if you... I mean, it might turn out to be some aspect of quantum tunneling, but it's much woolier than that as far as I've been able to figure out the cause of it. But pretty much every physicist I've been talking about Hawking's radiation is that it's ultimately based on the mass of the black hole and has no relationship with a thermal characteristic. I'll Google it again to just check on these things, but... I haven't seen any kind of documentation of thermal signatures of black holes, even on a theoretical basis. But I'll look it up.
Now, we've got a paradox here, Roy. Rotational kinetic energy. There have been observations of black holes where the material flowing around it is rotating very rapidly or quite rapidly. There seems to be a difference in rotational kinetic energy. How fast the...
Repeater, time out.
How fast the black hole is rotating seems to be real. Rotational kinetic energy, rotational velocity, let's call it. But you've got a problem once you accept rotational kinetic energy. It no longer can be a singularity. Because to have rotational kinetic energy, you have to have a property called moment of inertia. From all of our high school physics, from our college physics courses, moment of inertia is a function of how far the little chunks of mass are away from the rotational center. If you have a singularity, everything is at a dot in the center with no diameter. Something with zero diameter cannot have moment of inertia. To have rotational real energy, there's got to be moments of inertia. To have have moments of inertia, there has to be a finite diameter. If you've got a finite diameter, you're not a singularity. It is my belief that inside of every black hole, there is a distribution of the matter. It's not a singularity, it's not a dot in the center. Now, is it a Gaussian distribution? Is it a Rayleigh distribution? Is it a linear distribution? We can argue about that. But I think there's got to be a distribution. Once you accept a distribution inside of a black hole, then you don't need the period of expansion, of accelerated expansion, on after the Big Bang. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
Well, Dick,
you
know, it's a great theory. The problem is classical physics kind of doesn't work for a lot of things. It doesn't work for quantum mechanics at all, because we've sort of had this discussion that as far as physicists think right now, they think that basically the diameter of an electron is zero, that it actually is a point mass, and it has angular momentum. That's the spin that we talk about. It has different aspects of angular momentum. So in the quantum universe, and unfortunately black holes is where relativity meets quantum mechanics and wreaks havoc with both theories, you can have something that works like angular momentum without moments of inertia. Again, I give you the electron as candidate number 1, 2, and 3. It's strange. I'll give you that it's strange, and it makes very little sense to our classical physics programmed mind. But that seems to be what the physicists are discussing at this point.
I'm going to accept that an electron has an apparent diameter that is nearly zero, and a neutrino has a mass that is nearly zero, but they're not zero. It's got to be something a little bit greater than zero in order to have positive and negative spin of that electron. There have been a number of articles as to how tightly you can pack electrons. If you pack the whole universe with electrons as tightly as you possibly can, you get 10 to the 131 power of electrons in the observable universe. Was one of the calculations that was done by a couple of smart people that wrote the operating handbook for the Hewlett-Packard calculator. I can't think of the guy's name right now. So I think an electron has a diameter nearly zero. And as I said before, a neutrino has a mass that's nearly zero. But that neutrino will strike your detector and give you a flash of light. So if it's got the kinetic energy to do that, there's got to be some amount of mass. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
Well, I'll agree with you that neutrinos have mass because of the characteristics of them flipping from one flavor neutrino to another sort of requires that. So they do have a mass. It's a very, very small mass. But then you also have problems with quantum mechanics in that mass and energy are pretty much the same thing from a different viewpoint. So to say that something has mass is almost the same as saying it has energy, which is not saying much of anything. And unfortunately, they keep on trying to measure the diameter of an electron, and what they keep on getting is the lowest level of their measurement. If you believe, and you might not, I could understand why you wouldn't, in quantum field theory, and the reason why we have this unfortunate problem with wave-particle duality is because it's not quite a wave and it's not quite a particle. It's more of a probability quantum wave. So just like a waveform has a peak, it has no real dimension. I mean, you can talk about wavelengths and such, but the peak is just the strongest evidence of it. If you took three things that have those little peaks and put it close together, you could get a three-dimensional a composite dimension, which is what goes on with neutrons, protons, because they have three-point quarks that do that. But an electron by itself could theoretically be dimensionless and possess mass energy.
How about the mass of a photon? We think a photon has no mass. And yet, when a photon strikes an object, and you get the photoelectric effect, it's obvious that mass is required to do that. So, a photon seems to have no mass, but it's got to be greater than zero. And a neutrino has got some...
Repeater, time out.
Some mass greater than zero. I think an electron has a diameter very close to zero, but not quite zero. And in order to generate that wave, if it's got wave motion, you have to have a dimension across which you develop that wave. You can have a pure divergence of a charged particle that has no diameter, but that's not a wave. There's got to be a dimension to that charge in order to generate a wave, is my belief. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
No, Dick, I agree with you. The wave function, the quantum field theory wave function for an electron is operating in four-dimensional space-time. It has dimension. It's just that waves don't really lend themselves to actual length. There's a peak, and there's valleys, and there's more peaks, and there's cycles, but there's no discrete dimensions, and that's probably why we get confused about all this. And by the way, photons, it's probably more semantics than anything else. Photons have no rest mass. So if you stop a photon, it basically ceases to exist and has no mass. But it has a kind of inertial mass equivalent. That's if you talk quantum mechanically. If you unfortunately want to talk relativity, in which gravity is more of a dimensional concept than energy concept, space-time just gets folded by it, and it travels across the folds of space-time, and mass is kind of doesn't really mean that much about the photon. But that's the relativistic explanation for photon lensing, if you will. But that's what they kind of say, that it's an inertial equivalent mass, but it has a zero rest mass.
Is it possible an electron only has a wave motion, wave function, when it's in motion? That if you stop the electron from moving at all, maybe then it moves, it loses its dimension, and it loses its wave function. Over to you, Roy.
Okay, Dick, but riddle me this. Under what circumstances can you stop an electron completely? Now, keep in mind, if you think about the quantum mechanics, I know, please, don't think too much about the Bohr atom, because unfortunately, I don't know why they still promote that, because it gives you orbital mechanical concepts that don't correlate with quantum mechanics. All that we can do is define a probability cloud that electrons can exist within. We can't stop them. We can confine them to distances, but we can't stop them. So under what circumstances would you use to stop an electron?
I think it's possible to build a super cryogenic trap in which you can capture an electron. I know there's a particle that they've been able to do that, bosons, Einstein, condensate, whatever. I think it's possible to build a super cryogenic trap for an electron where you can confine it to one particular point in space with essentially zero velocity. I'm not sure on this one. K2LAW.
Okay, basically what you're talking about, or let me infer what you might be talking about, is absolute zero. At absolute zero, there is no kinetic energy, and everything stops moving, which unfortunately is why we'll never reach it. It's one of those asymptotic products, like anything with mass getting it up to the speed of light. You can get it very close to the speed of light, but you can't get it at the speed of light. And so any particle, because of quantum the difficulty of defining, a mass and momentum and velocity and position and such, it's just quantum is is not precise enough. It doesn't let you stop things. There's always going to be a bit of jitter in the background. The only jitter, if you can remove all the jitter, would be if you could theoretically get it to absolute zero Kelvin, which is probably why we're never going to be able to. So Bose condensates are very interesting structures, and they do all kinds of great things with it. It reduces a cloud of atoms to a single quantum mechanical atom, and it has wonderful properties. But it doesn't particularly stop electrons from jumping around.
A helium atom. Let me drop. To my knowledge, a helium atom has been cryogenically cooled to a micro degree or a nano degree. The temperature of something is its amount of kinetic energy. Kinetic energy is because of motion. So the translational motion of the helium atom has been brought to almost zero when you got it down to a nano Kelvin. So translational energy of the total helium atom. But that electron is still going around that proton in its quasi-normal manner at its normal velocity. If it didn't, it wouldn't have the centrifugal force to keep it away from the proton. The electron would crash into the proton and the two would annihilate each other. You'd have nothing. So a nano-Kelvin Bose-Einstein state of a helium atom, I think, is nearly zero translational velocity, but that's not slowing down the electron itself going around that proton. That's my belief. Over to you, Roy, T2IW.
Now, Dick, I would agree with you. I just would say that if it was possible, which it isn't possible, to get something at exactly 0 degrees, then pretty much it's by self-definition, everything stops. There is no kinetic energy of anything. It's an impossible state. The laws of physics kind of break down, just like they do in other conditions that are kind of strange and bizarre. And I don't think you could really describe why the electron doesn't drop into the nucleus as centrifugal force, because, again, that's orbital mechanics, not quantum mechanics. It has much more to do with wave functions of electrons and prohibited regions in the atom where their probability functions cancel out, and the possibility of them existing anywhere near the nucleus goes to zero, which I realize sounds really vague. And it would be nice if it was a more classical interpretation, but that's what I'm stuck with.
I think I agree with all of the above, and I've got to correct something I just said. I said if the electron crashed into the proton in the center of a helium atom, that they would destroy each other, and that's true. An electron that's crushed into a proton, that whole object becomes a neutron, I believe. Over to you, Roy.
Yes, Dick, it's called proton capture. It happens, it's mediated by our friend, the weak nuclear force, which, the weak nuclear force is the force that allows quarks to change flavor. And so it will flip the flavor of some quarks, which will then change its charge and will then emit a charged weak force boson. So that's proton capture of an electron.
And how much of that is required for nuclear fusion to take place, Roy? What's going on in the center of the sun?
Well, one of the earliest steps in fusion, ultimately what's going on is hydrogen is fused to helium. But along the way, a hydrogen has to with a helium and produce a deuterium atom from proton capture. So it's incredibly important. If you don't have that first stage where the deuterium is produced, the collision with another hydrogen with another deuterium, isn't going to happen. So it's very important. And matter of fact, you were talking about neutron stars. One of the basic things that happens when neutron stars are born, the force repelling electrons and protons from each other is called photon degeneracy pressure. In the case of a proto-neutron star, the gravitational force overcomes that enormous pressure and produces proton capture of electrons, and a star made up of mostly shear neutrons, where they started off with neutrons, protons, and electrons. So that's my little bit on neutron stars as well.
Can a neutron star have charge? If all of the electrons have been crushed into the protons, is a neutron star by definition always neutral in charge?
I think the get-out-of-jail-free card, you sort of mentioned the uniformity of a neutron star, but there's a lot of strangeness that goes on at the very surface interface. You have to understand that it's in an equilibrium condition of the proton degeneracy pressure inside, and at the very surface of the neutron star, there's a lot less gravitational acting upon these things. So it's probably able to free electrons and possess some nominal charge. I don't know if it's significant, but I think it's doable.
The universe contains more binary stars than unary stars. Our star happens to be unary, which is a little bit more rare than binary. When it comes to a pair of neutron stars that come together, the LIGO instrument will give you a nice big signal. When it comes to a pair of black holes coming together, which have a lot more mass, the signal is not as big and the signal is more brief. I think you get an actual bigger, longer signal out of a pair of neutron stars coming together. We got to do some checking on that. Over to you, Roy. KQIW.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dick. Matter of fact, that's why they tend to be working on getting the length of the detectors and getting the frequency resolutions better and better, because it's a function of mass and it's a function of what objects are involved. And neutron stars seem to kind of light up the sky, whereas a black hole falling into another black hole just gives you gravitational waves and not a heck of a lot of other things. Whereas when those neutron stars collided with each other, it was a fireworks display. They were detecting signatures of gold being produced as a side effect.
Yeah, in the case of a pair of neutron stars coming together, you could aim a telescope at that point in the sky and see emissions of various wavelengths. Let me drop. Now, there was an article recently about a breakthrough that was made with a laser beam width. Laser beam width are normally numbers like 10 kilohertz wide, and a real good one is 1 kilohertz wide, and they found a way of making the beam width of a laser oscillator 10 hertz wide. And if that kind of super stable laser was used on LIGO, you get a much more pure null. And when the null of the LIGO instrument is a deeper null, more stable null, the whole instrument becomes more sensitive to a perturbation of a gravity wave coming by. So there's a whole bunch of techniques by which LIGO is in the process right now of becoming more sensitive. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW. And by the way, when we build a LIGO in free space, I think we will find a hell of a lot more objects coming together. Stars, as well as neutron stars, and white dwarfs, and black, and so on. Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I was going to mention that before, because the European Space Agency has plans of putting the LISA up. It's called the LISA mission. They want to put basically LIGO in space. You know, a million kilometers apart from one another. They're going to need like three of these satellites, and they're going to be thrown around the sun in a heliocentric orbit. But, you know, we got to wait until 2033 for that to happen. But yeah, there is plans for that. They can lower the frequencies that are coming in. That's what they want to do. And like Dick said before, you'll be able to get a lot more black holes coming together.
I agree with you entirely, Paul. This is a brave new world. Basically, this is a ginned-up Michelson-Morley interferometer. It's over 100 years old, but the basic underlying design, although the precision of it is incredible and getting better. And, you know, it's kind of like a blind guy who's given back his sight. This is, to me, probably even a little bit more important than the discovery of radio astronomy. This is an entire different modality of poking around at the universe and figuring out a lot of things. So this is exciting stuff. I mean, one of the first stories that I enjoyed doing here was with LIGO and such. It's incredible what the future might bring us. The understanding of black holes and neutron stars and what causes gamma bursts and all kinds of fun. Hey, Doug, it's been fun. We had a puzzle night, which is probably a good thing for Super Bowl. So I want to thank everyone who participated in our little puzzle night. Once again, if you have any comments, topics, questions, or puzzles of your own, send them to me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. Mailbag@ac2gs.com. And pretty much not post any other articles, because I didn't really get any other articles. But if you want to see a nice picture of Bennu, you go to roy.ac2gs.com. And I'll be back next week with hopefully some puzzles and stories. Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Paul.
Now, here comes some space report. Go right ahead, Roy. And that LIGO needs a 4-kilometer-long tunnel with extremely good vacuum so that the air molecules don't disturb that beam. And if you can put that beam in free space, which is an even better vacuum, you can make the tunnel longer, the purity of the vacuum higher, and therefore detectivity becomes a lot more sensitive. WS2N, D2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is WS2N, the Space Net report for the TechNet, and that's what the European Space Agency did. They put the, called it LISA Pathfinder up there. I was just to see if technically it would be able to work, you know, if they could detect any kind of motion. And they had a couple of denser cubes, actually, that were put inside one satellite. It all had the lasers and everything. They were just trying to see if there would be any kind of detection. And then, you know, they figured a number. Okay, this was their guess, and it turned out to be 5 times more sensitive than they even thought. So they know it's going to work, and that's why they planned on 2033 for a true launch of a triple satellite system. Back to Dick, and I'll continue on.
Paul, is there any way you can aim your antenna a little bit better and or give us a little bit more power? You can hear the crackling sound on my voice coming through the machine, and you're making a similar cracking sound. If I go to higher power, I can lower my amount of crackle, as you can see, which is what I just did. Over to you, Paul. If you don't do it, it's okay, but it's just a little bit more annoying to hear that crackle.
Oh, no, I went back up. This is probably better. I try to keep it on this. What is it, 35 watts? It's better than 75. Overheating. Although I have an extra fan on this thing. I really don't have to worry about it. Unless I go on too long. How's this, back up?
A little bit better. There's still some crackle, but just, any chance that if you aim the antenna a couple of degrees clockwise or a couple of degrees counterclockwise, it'll get better? However, when you're aiming the antenna, tell me it's 1 degree clockwise, 2 degrees clockwise, 3 degrees clockwise. That way we can compare the amount of crackle and say, go back to the 2 degree point, if you know what I mean. If you think antenna aiming will do anything, it's worth a try, Paul. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to go north a little bit. Don't want to go. I think I'm kind of locked in there. I might
have it one way.
Okay.
A little tight after the ice. All right, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's going north. Any better from 1 to 5?
I think 3 is a good number, Paul, but I'm not positive.